Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Republican state lawmakers continue to work on a proposal to make it harder for citizens to amend Ohio's state constitution. The measure would require at least a 60% majority from voters to enact constitutional amendments initiated by citizens or, now, the legislature. The proposal comes as multiple future state ballot issues are on tap, addressing everything from abortion rights to redistricting. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Andy.
Hi, Ann.
And Andrew J. Tobias, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back.
Good morning.
All right. So they did tweak it. They were getting some pushback because the original version only had to do with citizen initiatives, and this includes legislative. Why is that important?
Yeah, so just to kind of recap, there are different ways that you can amend the state constitution, but they all require the voters to ultimately approve it in a statewide vote. So currently, it's just kind of the normal simple majority 50% plus one vote standard that voters have to pass something by. And this proposal would raise that to 60%, which is substantially higher. And it might not sound like a lot, but that's actually really a lot when you look at how, for instance, and we'll probably talk about this, but various abortion measures, either in favor of abortion rights or against restriction, basically people on the side of abortion rights have won all these different votes in these states across the country. I don't believe that any of those besides the bluest of the blue states have exceeded 60% approval. So states like Kansas, Michigan, Kentucky. And so the proposal initially would have only set the 60% bar for citizen-initiated amendments. And the legislature or the Republican lawmakers have decided to also make it 60% for, as you said, those that come from the state legislature itself. So the reason why they did that, it's basically to make a simpler argument, is what State Representative Brian Stewart told me. It's kind of that's one of the things that opponents would have latched onto in the campaign. They've already, you know, kind of criticized them for the double standard, basically. So that's why they did it. But really, you know, it's fundamentally the 60% thing is still in place, and that's going to be a difficult bar for anything to be approved for.
There was a commission that was reviewing potential changes to the Constitution a few years back, I think 2017 or something around there, and they recommended perhaps a 55% bar. They went with 60%. And if I understand it correctly, Representative Stewart kind of just said, "Oh, it's just a numbers game." And
yeah, he's
one
like,
is
"Well,
the same as another.
More than 50, less than 67. Why not 60?"
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know, I would go back to the. I mean, I don't know how much of this is driven by the abortion issue. I suspect more than what sort of proponents are going to let on. But that 60% number is going to be difficult to clear for anything with any remote level of controversy. And maybe that's, you know, for the best for people who think that the, you know, state constitution should be changed in very limited circumstances. You know, this whole process would still preserve the 50% plus one threshold for citizen-initiated laws, for referendums on laws. So kind of more of the legislative process, not the state constitutional amendment. But yeah, they said 60%, even though this commission just recently, and I believe Bob Kupp, the current House Speaker, was on the subcommittee that recommended the 55% threshold. But yeah, I guess 60% is the number that they like the best for whatever reason.
And it is in a state that is completely controlled by one party from stem to stern. It's a lot of people are frustrated because they feel like this is the last sort of bastion. The electorate in Ohio, for example, doesn't agree with the state legislature and the majority there on a couple different issues, including legalization of marijuana and abortion rights.
Yeah. So when citizen groups speak out against this and when they talk about the ability for voters to put something on the ballot, they talk about how voters have a chance for direct democracy when if they want to pass something there that the legislature is not looking at, they're able to bypass the legislature and take it straight to the voters. And it's been something that's been touted here in Ohio for decades. And I think another interesting thing to point out is raising the threshold to pass an initiative, especially when you're looking at the citizen-led initiatives, is that they already have a hard time getting a simple majority. For the past several years, we haven't seen them able to pass a constitutional amendment with that simple majority vote. So raising that threshold seems to be adding just another step to it already. When you look at the legislative-led amendments, those have been able to pass with a wide amount of support. It could be because the political machines that are behind the legislative movement to get it out of the General Assembly also back those measures when they take it out on the campaign trail. And so there are several community groups, lots of community groups, actually a collection of more than 140 groups have kind of coalesced against this. And they say that this is just a major setback for the voters' ability to have direct democracy.
There is a group. Well, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. And joining us is Andrew J. Tobias of Cleveland.com and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Obviously, there's an organization now. It's the same group, correct me if I'm wrong, that brought the Senate Bill 5 to the ballot.
Yeah, We Are Ohio.
Yeah, We Are Ohio. So they've got experience in fighting back on these things, but what is your expectations that Ohio voters would approve it?
So there was a couple of these in other states this past cycle, and because this came up in lame duck, we've kind of all had to rapidly become experts on this subject, and they're just things I don't even know about. But so in South Dakota and Kansas, I believe, or maybe it's Oklahoma, they defeated these. And I've done very cursory research into those two states. I believe in Oklahoma, if I'm getting my Great Plains state correct, that the measure to make it harder to amend the state constitution there was backed by casino interests. They essentially wanted to prevent other competitors. They wanted to do something to basically solidify the rights they had in the state constitution there. And it failed by a 2-to-1 margin. I know less about the South Dakota measure, but it also failed there. And so we've seen that happen in other states. And what I've seen kind of ads and what they kind of told voters and apparently convinced them to vote against it was that they said things like this change would end majority rule, you know, and it would get rid of one man, one vote sort of principles when it comes to the state constitution. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how this actually gets, you know, messaged out if this makes the ballot. And, you know, we're looking at right now the state legislature, Bob Cupp, the speaker, has basically said that this needs to pass during the lame duck session or else it'll be very unlikely to be able to get it on the May ballot, which is what they're aiming for right now. But that's the target right now is the May ballot is when it's come up for a vote.
And that's why it has to go through lame duck in this way to get it done in time.
Right. It would have to be passed through this resolution where a 3/5 majority of the legislature would have to agree on the House and the Senate and by the end of the year in order to put it into the May ballot. And what's significant about that, too, is that that would be an odd numbered spring primary where this major piece of potential constitutional change would be put up to voters at a time when turnout is very low. I think the interesting thing to really talk about, too, is what we hear the talking point from the Republicans who want this is the idea of special interests, the idea of groups coming in and spending a lot of money. They say that Ohio is sort of up for rent where these groups can come in, spend a lot of money, and then buy their way into the state constitution. Again, what we've seen in the past is that it's hard to even get a simple majority for these issues where a lot of money has come in. The people who are against this, the groups that are speaking out against this resolution, also say that if you raise that threshold to 60%, you're just inviting the special interest to put more money into the legislature and to like seek out changes through the legislature instead. So they say you shut off one valve, then it just opens up another when it comes to special interest money.
But I think there would be a very well-funded campaign definitely against this.
I'm wondering about the campaign for it. I mean, who's going to stick their neck out and spend money on that?
So on the against, I would guess, We Are Ohio is basically a union-tied group. They're pursuing a $15 minimum wage issue, which they've been working on a minimum wage hike for a while. I would expect that you would see marijuana is going through an initiated statute, which is not what we're talking about procedurally, but I could see groups like that nationally kind of with interest in doing things in Ohio in the future, which, you know, we talk about the abortion issue, which, by the way, would be a source of funding for this, advocates for abortion rights. But then also there are other issues down the road that maybe we don't even know about yet. And so there might be people who would come out of the woodwork for that kind of thing, too. So on the for side, I would expect to see that, and I'm just kind of off the cuff here a little bit because, like I said, this is kind of coming up quickly and I haven't had a chance to do all the reporting, but the Chamber of Commerce has been in favor of doing something like this for a while. They point to the casino issue in 2009 as kind of like the quintessential. Is it 2009? Yeah, I think it's 2009.
Mm-hmm.
The quintessential example of special interest taking over the state constitution. What happened that year was after failing several times to legalize gambling in Ohio, some casino businesses passed a, they put a, one of these on the ballot. It passed very narrowly. I think it was like 52%, 51%. It would not have cleared even the 55% threshold that we were talking about earlier, and created casinos in the big cities, including the real estate parcels. It was very specific. And so things like that, you know, I think that business groups see one of these comes up or seems to every few years. And I think that they don't like the idea of, like, you know, repelling some weird change to Ohio's business environment from some outside interest group. So that's sort of the idea, is that these kinds of things, when they kind of come out of left field, can create an unstable business climate.
And then all of a sudden they have to suit up and fight against whatever outside interest comes in to try to change the constitution. So all of a sudden these business groups or whoever else might be against it have to spend more campaign money for something that maybe they weren't predicting they had to fight against.
Yes, we saw a marijuana legalization measure that was backed by people that wanted to have a business monopoly in marijuana business. I think it's 2015. In 2017, I believe, we saw one that would have set greater regulations on drug prices, which had very wide-ranging mm-hmm. business ramifications. There was another one. I'm blanking. Oh, it was had to do with basically criminal sentencing reform for drug mm-hmm. convictions. Mm-hmm. So just these things come up, and they, you know, the kind of back to like bring this full circle, they almost always fail. Even under the current right. kind of majority requirement, they fail. The ones that have cleared the bar, that have come from citizens, include the casino thing I just talked about. And then in 2006, they raised the minimum wage to the current level. And that, I think that was 57%. So that would have cleared the 55% threshold that the commission that studied this issue recommended. It would not have cleared the 60% that Republican lawmakers are looking for right now.
And there are people who will say, well, we need the opportunity to change the Constitution. We need to be able to have this opportunity to bypass the legislature to make policy that we want. The Republicans who are supporting this resolution say they still have that opportunity through an initiated statute where you can take it to the ballot and change Ohio law, not the Ohio Constitution.
But you have to go through the Ohio General Assembly to do that, and it can be very time consuming because they can put off taking action on that
yep.
until the last minute.
Which is what we just saw with recreational marijuana,
right.
where they were trying to go through that. There are so many more hurdles. You get signatures, you send the language to the legislature, you wait to see if the legislature passes it. If they don't, you get more signatures, you put it on the ballot, you might pass it on the ballot, and then at any point the legislature could pass a bill to change it again. And that's why people want to go through the Constitution instead, because it's much harder to change the Constitution. So there are people who are out there who would like to see special interest groups limited on how often they come to change the Constitution, but they don't like this resolution. They say another proposal could be to strengthen that citizens' initiative where, yes, if you do go the route of an initiated statute where you change the Ohio law, then the legislature cannot change that law for a period of 3, 4, 5 years.
We will take a break. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also with us, Andrew J. Tobias of Cleveland.com. And also joining us, Anna Staver, State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Anna Staver, State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
And still with us, Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Andrew J. Tobias of Cleveland.com. The House passed a bill last Thursday that ensures access to gun stores during states of emergency. It has its roots in early days of the pandemic and stay-at-home orders, right, Anna Staver?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing. So when governors across the country did those stay-at-home orders, Governor Mike DeWine put a carve-out in for gun stores, calling them essential businesses, but other states didn't do that. And I guess that worried some conservatives about the potential for, you know, a different governor, a different set of beliefs. And so they wanted to sort of enshrine this idea that they can't be closed. There's also this fear that sort of stems from some, at this point, urban legends about Katrina and seizure of guns and confiscation of weapons post-flood. So there was this story that cops were going around and taking guns from people after Katrina because, you know, it was lawlessness. And so they wanted to make sure that that wasn't something that could happen here in Ohio either.
Okay.
Yeah, it brings back that when in 2020, when businesses started to shut down and everybody's scrambling, looking around, wondering who is essential, who is non-essential, quote unquote. And this would establish that stores that sell firearms would be essential businesses. So it does feel like kind of a remnant of the pandemic era. And who knows what that means for the future, but it does sort of tie up kind of a loose end that's been floating out there for a couple of years.
Another nail in the coffin of local control, Andrew J. Tobias.
I mean, it just depends on what you're trying to control. but yeah, I mean, you could look at it that way for sure.
I mean, big cities have a different scenario perhaps than rural areas.
Yeah, and there was a Democrat, I can't remember who right now, his name is escaping me, who said basically, we just put restrictions on what you can bring to a protest. So like having a brick at a protest is no longer legal.
The legislature did this.
But being able to buy a gun during a riot is legal or would be legal under this. And so there's some confusing question about like how cities can best protect in, say, large demonstration situations.
It's expected to pass?
Yeah, pass the House, right?
And
so it would go into the Senate, and I think there is an appetite in the Senate to pass it as well. It's interesting, in the Senate, there's a different bill sponsored by Republican Senator Matt Dolan that would make changes to the way somebody buys a firearm. It would add another quote-unquote disability to the list, where if you are found through a behavior risk assessment to be either suicidal or homicidal, you would have to check that box. It would come up, theoretically, in background checks. So that's kind of the other side of the coin when it comes to extending regulations, taking away some regulations, and there is not an appetite for that in the Senate. Republican Senate President Matt Huffman says that that's not going to come to a vote on the Senate floor. Maybe this essential business for gun stores will come to the floor.
Well, it's a Senate bill, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. I think it is, but they made modifications in the House, so now it's got to go back to the Senate for concurrence.
Okay, so it'd be as simple as one more vote on the Senate floor.
It's a question I should have asked earlier about the constitutional amendment issue, but I'll start with this. What's the governor saying?
So far, I haven't heard him say anything about this.
Yeah, he's generally said that he favors gun rights, and even though he had his attempt to impose additional gun restrictions kind of like slapped down. So I don't know. Like, it's actually interesting. I don't think he's commented on this one yet.
But he did make that carve out during COVID, so that could signal his approval for such measures.
Mm. Okay, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And as far as the constitutional amendment process goes, is he studying it or what's going on? Do we know?
Yeah, taking a look at it. Hasn't read. I think he may have said something like, I haven't taken a close look at that yet, but we're keeping an eye on it.
He indicated he plans to comment, but just kind of, you know, crucially on this, the governor's approval is not required for this to make the ballot. Basically, you need 60% of each the House and the Senate to make the ballot, and the governor plays no role. So even if he thought it was the worst idea ever, I guess it doesn't really matter because he doesn't have a say in it.
No one cares. Okay, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Andrew J. Tobias of Cleveland.com. Also with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Anna Staver of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Anna, they're looking at a big change to the Ohio Department of Education, big changes to the Ohio Department of Education. Is this a lame duck thing, or something that's going to happen very quickly, or what?
It sounds like it might happen very quickly, since Senate President Matt Huffman says this is one of his priorities. So, I mean, It would sound like it could potentially, but it really touches on three different areas of education. So the first is career technical education. It sort of elevates it on par with like K through 12 and post-secondary. And most people are largely supportive of that. They're like, you know, mm-hmm. especially with Intel and Honda, there's lots of like need for like technical training and trade schools and that type of education. So it would create a new head of the director of a deputy director for career technical education housed within ODE and really elevate that department. The two other big changes are the controversial ones. The first is it would create a cabinet level position for the governor. They would be the new director of education and workforce. So ODE would now be DEW, which I guess is a better acronym. So the director of DEW would be appointed by the governor. I just like saying
DEW. We're just gonna keep going with it.
Oh yeah, I love it. So the director of DEW would be in the governor, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and then they would be the person in charge. So right now that's the state superintendent, and they get appointed by the school board. That position would still exist, but it would be more of a supervisory advisory position to this new director.
The superintendent. And it would still exist?
Yes, but they wouldn't have the power that
sounds they like
do
a lot
now.
Of chiefs. It sounds like a lot of cooks in the kitchen. Let me see what else can I.
Well, yeah. It's also because the state board would be stripped of most of its educational like oversight responsibilities and policy making responsibilities. They'd still do like teacher licensure and like territory transfers.
Rubber stamping stuff.
Yeah. And so they mm-hmm. would still get to pick that superintendent. I think that's in like constitutional statute. Like I think the creation of the board and the superintendent. So you can't change that without an amendment, but you can make them powerless.
Yeah, I mean, that's so, the voters. This is taking, again, some power away from the voters again.
Well, and going back to your idea, the question about local control, the state board is made up of local people in different districts who are voted to then go to the state board to speak on behalf of their constituents. And you asked, is this a lame duck thing or something that's going to be passed through? This has always been a lame duck thing for years and years and years. But it does seem like this might be the time where it
you
actually
mean it's been
does.
Brought up year after year during lame duck session.
Yes, it's brought up and brought up. And you always hear more momentum coming in right at the last minute and then kind of falters at the last second. And it does seem like maybe this is on track to pass.
And then, by the way, three Democrats were elected to the state school board during this last round, right?
Yeah. So the board is 19 members. 11 are elected and 8 are appointed by the governor. So of those 11 elected, 3 flipped or 3 went for the more they're nonpartisan positions, but you kind of know who is who.
They were backed by unions.
Yeah. And Democrats mm-hmm. and Republican parties. So 3 of those went to more Democratic members, which would give them a more solid majority on the board. But like the wild card is eight appointees by the governor is like, you know, nothing to sneeze at.
Right.
And we talked to Governor DeWine about this, and we like we just said, with other pieces of legislation, he'll say, oh, I'm taking a look at it. He's not definitive. He says he's for this. He was more definitive when it comes to this. He said, as many other governors have for generations before me, they've all been pushing for something like this. And Governor DeWine is supporting this bill. He says that it brings more accountability to the governor's office. He believes that the governor should be more accountable to the state's education.
So does it leave the state board then? It leaves it powerless, basically. I mean, I wonder, is it duplicative? I mean, is it duplicative? Is that the right word? Does it duplicate or is it unnecessary at this point? Is it sort of like, what organ don't we use? Oh, the appendix.
Oh, you mean for the state? Well, I mean, the state board would require a constitutional statute to remove. So,
but you still have to pay for all those people and pay for all
But teacher licensure and suspension and revocation is like still serious work. Like, you know, figuring out if somebody's committed an egregious enough offense to forever lose
like
their teacher
license.
Like
the state medical board.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't downplay the importance of that function. Like they really do make that decision on whether you get to keep your license.
Huffman, Senate President Matt Huffman seemed to believe that there was a lot on the plate of the state board members who don't get their own staff, I think he said, and says that there's a lot of responsibility that hinges on people who are essentially working a part-time job. So, you know, and his argument would be that the responsibilities that are still going to be left up to the State Board of Education is more than enough and on par with how much time is devoted to that job.
It is kind of strange to think that an entity that's going to be doing the kinds of things that Anna was just saying, reviewing teacher discipline, would be overseen by elected officials. Like, so that's going to be kind of the weird vestigial aspect of this that will be in place if, in fact, this passes. But because like you mentioned, the state medical board is an appointed entity. It's basically like a functionary position.
That's true. It's not, and they're not exactly parallel.
Yeah, there's no like local control policy question about whether a teacher has, you know, violated their personnel agreements or something like that. So that does point to it not being mismatched with sort of the way that it was created. But that's also kind of like, if they really wanted to get rid of this, they'd have to change the constitution. And that's apparently really easy in some cases and also very difficult in others. So
depending
exactly.
on who you ask.
Yeah.
And when you ask.
And, you know, the argument that I find interesting is like the governor has a lot of cabinet positions, like the Ohio Department of Health, the Ohio Department of Medicaid. Like a lot of these big agencies do have a cabinet level position.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I get it makes sense.
Yeah.
We're also in a time when we saw the trend the past couple of years of a lot of attention being paid to these local school board races, a lot of money from groups coming into these local school board races. Education has been politicized so much lately. Mm-hmm. I wonder what this would do to that. Maybe it would become even more of a political
supercharge
issue.
It, yeah.
If you have a governor out there who, on top of campaigning on things like health and all these other things that have cabinet level positions, to then start campaigning about education, I wonder how that would change the dynamic of everything.
Yeah. So this is expected to go through. I mean, you got Senate President Matt Huffman's on board.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hearing that we could get it out of the Senate this week,
yeah.
which would then put it over in the House with 2 weeks to, I guess, debate and pass. So, but the thing to keep in mind is, too, I haven't seen yet opposition testimony. We've seen interested party testimony. We've seen concerns. And I'll be curious to see if any of the major groups really comes out forcefully against the idea.
The one thing I'll also say is House Speaker Bob Kupp has been sort of quiet on a lot of things. He doesn't want to take a definitive stance on a lot of things. The one thing he's been absolutely sure of is that he does not want to be working the week before Christmas. So if that is
what a spine.
The case,
yeah.
If that is the case, well, he has to balance a lot of different caucuses and
sure.
stuff. But if that's the case, then we have about 2 weeks of policymaking left. Of course, we always talk about that, and then lame duck seems to always go on longer than we would expect. So mm-hmm. who knows?
Speaking, I mean, he's the ultimate lame duck, too. So who cares?
House Speaker Bob Kupp.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's
his replacement has been chosen.
Yeah, yeah. His replacement has been chosen. All that stuff has been taken care of. I'm thinking about teacher unions, those groups. Ohio Education Association?
So the Ohio Education Association testified last week, and as an interested party, not as an opponent, which just means we're curious but unsure. but Scott DeMauro, the president, said, look, I'm not saying no. I'm saying let's have this conversation next year. Let's take more time. Let's talk about what this is going to mean. Like when we create this new Department of Education and Workforce, are all the jobs going to transfer? Are we going to have a different org chart? Like what's going to happen to like the 700 employees at ODE?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm wondering about.
Yeah.
What are they going to be doing, twiddling their thumbs? I mean, I know they'll be doing the teacher
yeah.
licensure things, but.
So, yeah, his thing was, look, we're not saying no. What we're saying is, let's not rush through this in lame duck.
Well, what
let's
is the rush for?
Year.
Why does this pop up during lame duck? And what is the rush? I mean,
I wonder if it's hard to campaign off of. I wonder if there's something to do with when you put it out there and then you have to campaign off of it. But
I don't know. So Senator Reinicke, who introduced this more than a year ago, but it was a placeholder bill. It just said it was four sentences that said something like, I intend to remake the Ohio Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't until a couple weeks ago that we actually saw what that meant. So I don't know. He had it out there for a year before he put actual language to it.
And he introduced it in the last General Assembly. This has been his big issue for since he's been in the legislature. I think he was a representative and he introduced it when Kasich was around.
Did it change much?
No, the tenets are still the same. I think the DO part, the workforce is the newer stuff.
The all-important new acronym for ODE. But no, it is interesting. His big thing is when you go to college, like 20% of Ohio students have to take remedial math and English courses. And he just thinks that's appalling and it really bothers him. And arguably, we could be much better at that. And he thinks that, you know, ODE is failing kids if one in five graduate and then need to take high school classes over again in college.
And they think they can do a better job at an executive level.
That's his theory.
Agency.
And I will say, like, the state school board is not the most functional of state fair. Bodies. They've failed to replace a superintendent. I don't know. Has it been 2 years since the
year?
A year and a half.
Yeah.
So there's been no superintendent in place. We've had people get appointed and then step down very quickly. You know, so it's just, you know, and if you actually watch the meetings, which I really wouldn't recommend unless you have a lot of time. They just argue a lot. They don't necessarily pass anything. They've gotten very caught up in the sort of cultural controversies mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So I'm sure, you know, nobody's going to shed a tear for like the paragon of effectiveness if this, you know, if the organization is just kind of fundamentally reorganized. So I did want to throw that out there. It is a very challenged organization as it stands right now.
I think it's ironic, though, that it's coming out of a body that has its own troubles getting anything done.
Yeah, do you think the governor would like to reorganize the Ohio House, for example?
Well, I mean, workers' compensation. Uh-huh. I'm sorry. Unemployment compensation, yep. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There's a lot of undone business at the state legislative level, too. And on that note, I'll end this segment, and we'll take a quick break. My guests are Anna Staver of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Andrew J. Tobias of Cleveland.com. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Anna Staver of USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Andrew J. Tobias of Cleveland.com. Okay, we got some really important issues here. But let's start with a truly important issue. The governor is advising Ohio lawmakers to exercise caution when considering changes to Ohio's abortion laws. What is your sense, Andy Chow, that they'll heed that advice from somebody who is obviously opposes abortion rights, you know, and wants abortion control?
Are you asking if the Republican leadership's going to listen to Governor DeWine? Probably not.
Okay.
I mean, I guess if the advice is to give it a lot of thought, I think they are giving it some thought. There's a lot of moving parts here, one of it being that Ohio's current abortion restriction is on hold by the court. So if you pass something now, would you have to pass something again once the court makes its final decision when it comes to Ohio's abortion ban? There was talk about a week ago about legislators still moving forward on a total ban on abortion. I think it was Laura Bischoff with Anna's bureau who asked Republican Senate President Matt Huffman if that's still on the table. He said, I can't say yes, I can't say no. Or you asked it too?
No, it was me, not Laura.
Oh, okay.
That's really fine.
The question is, can't say yes, can't say no, but it's highly unlikely that it's going to pass out of this General Assembly, the complete ban on abortion. So the question is, do they still take on new language when it comes to the six-week restriction, especially when it comes to what are some of the exceptions? When can doctors still perform abortions? And that's one of the big questions out there.
And what do you think, Andrew?
I mean, I haven't talked to the governor about this, although, you know, maybe we will soon. But I think that if I'm the governor and I'm looking at this, if they were to pass a very just to be clear, Ohio already has a very restrictive abortion law. But if they were to pass something even more restrictive, particularly a total ban, I think it's very likely that it would be subject to a referendum. They would be inviting something like that. If you kind of game that out, that happens in 2023, that would give, you know, Democrats some energy heading into 2024. Maybe there will be other things that will be on the ballot if, you know, depending on how this constitutional amendment thing goes. So that's mm-hmm. the kind of thing they probably have in mind is, you know, not inviting controversy. And I've had this kind of lingering suspicion that there also might be some economic development project in the works. And I think there's always concern among people in the business sector, if there's some really controversial hot button social issue that pops up as something is being considered, that maybe a state would, or an entity or like a company would pick some other state, if maybe it's like a tiebreaker or something like that. So I think those are the kinds of things that they have in mind is tactical things, as opposed to, you know, the governor has been very clear that he's against abortion. He's, you know, said in the past that he would support passing, going quote as far as they could go, basically, if Roe versus Wade were overturned. So I think it's probably more of a tactical argument like that. But that's the kind of thing that would you start thinking about if something like that were to move forward, is how would it play out politically? How would a referendum campaign get organized? What would be the ramifications of that, stuff like that?
I mean, I think about, let's just say hypothetically, the Intels of the world, that they would see around such a tactic.
Yeah, and I also think it's, you know, people, I think there are some Republicans that I've talked to on background, so I can't say who oppose abortion access, like they don't believe in abortion for religious reasons, but they've said, you know, look, long term, what is the most restriction, like practically speaking, that we can have that won't be subject to referendum, like purely strategic, like if we go full personhood amendment, which means life begins at conception, there is no abortion except for very rare restrictive life of the mother exemptions. They're like, look, that's probably going to get overturned. And it's probably going to get overturned by something that has some very loose, say, restrictions. And their concern is like, should we pass something more moderate that can withstand the test of time? Or should we leave it up to the people who may arguably go for something well beyond what we could have capped, if that makes sense?
Yeah, and that is what the governor was also talking about when he was calling on the legislature to give it a second thought, because when you look at the general public and polling among the general public, they do fall in that more moderate space where they're not for complete unrestricted abortion access, but they're also not for a complete ban on abortion either. They fall somewhere in the middle, and about, I think, a little bit more than 60% of people fall in that category. Which again goes back to the supermajority thing when we're talking about the constitutional amendment and if there's enough votes out there for something like that.
But the heartbeat pill itself, which is the heartbeat law, I guess, can't be subject to referendum because it was passed years ago and just got held up in court, and the window to actually conduct one of these referendums closed during that time. So just that's of note, that that's not something that can happen, you know, to that law specifically.
Right. Although, and it's, you know, the court case, there really are two arguments. One is whether there's a constitutional protection to abortion in Ohio's constitution, and the other is whether the law was too vague, which may be why we're seeing some of this possible clarifying around life of the mother exemptions, because they could be like, hey, we fixed it. It's no longer too vague. So the court could rule that there is no constitutional right to abortion in Ohio's state constitution, but that this law was too vague and poorly written to stand. So they're like, there is a window in which, like, perhaps what they're gaming out right now is like, how do we bolster that definition against this particular court challenge?
This is more of a question, but if they touch that language again, is it then open to a referendum? Do they have to be careful not to change the line?
I don't think that they could just go and repeal the whole thing if they were to change it. I think the referendum would be subject to the changes that they make.
Yeah,
and then
that's what I think.
It would revert to sort of the status quo of the 2019 law if that were to be successful.
So the legislature would have to be very careful of what language they're actually changing as well.
But if they did a personhood amendment, that could be subject to referendum, absolutely. Yeah. And that's my biggest question with bringing, and I don't know if you guys know better than I do, but I can't get a good answer on, if they bring, say, life of the mother exemptions to the floor, how do they stop a floor amendment with personhood in it?
We saw that with some of the transgender bills too, right? If they open the floor up to that type of subject, then there's a further right section of the Republican caucus that could go in that direction.
Ooh, so exciting. Ohio Senate has passed a bill that reduces training for cosmetology and barber licenses. I'm just reading the headline from your story, Andy Chow, on that score. What was the impetus for this?
This has been something that's floated around for years and years, too. Again, one of the lame duck greatest hits is changing the barber and cosmetology license. This always comes up every General Assembly, and then it's always met by a big backlash from the industry, people who say, no, you should not reduce these standards because it lowers the standards. It sort of demeans our profession, and they say that the schools need to be able to teach the people the full span of what it means to be a cosmetologist or a barber and not just the health and safety stuff.
Proponents say this is important because
it would help grow the industry. It would make it a little bit easier to get a license. You could get the what they're proposing is the 1,000 hours of training and then go to a salon to get the rest of your training. Again, the backlash to that is if you go to a salon, you might sign a big non-compete contract.
Right.
You're stuck in an apprenticeship for a long time. Pros and cons on both sides. The thing here is this seemed to be the one General Assembly where we were going to go the whole time without seeing this proposal. There is more of a moderate bipartisan bill to make small changes to cosmetology and barber. And then the Senate added this amendment in. Representative Sobecki, the Democrat who was on board with the bipartisan House bill, I talked to her in the hallway and she's like, I'm taking my name off this bill.
Oh.
So Democrats are upset about it. Salon schools are upset about it, especially these last minute changes.
Is there salient evidence that there is a shortage of cosmetologists/barbers out there?
When you talk to people who are proponents of this bill, they talk about different regions of Ohio where you see salons closing and different shops having a hard time filling vacancies for staffing and everything like that. I think Dayton was brought up as an area where maybe some salons were closing. So that has been brought up in the past. And the other idea here is that the legislature, especially the more conservative lawmakers, want to make getting a licensure for several different professions just easier, to make it easier to gain access to that profession. And this is one of those areas. New York, which Republicans will say is the cosmetology capital of the world, has just 1,000 hours of requirement to get a license.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the funny thing when you dive into licensure. It's done by the states, and every state does it differently. And some states license certain things and others don't. Like, there's one state, I can't remember which, that licensed florists, and it's, like, the only state in the nation where you need a florist's license.
Wow.
So, like, state licensure is wild when you, like, dive into, like, what people license.
It's usually a money grab of some sort.
To a certain extent. And that's the thing. That's, like exactly what Andy was saying, is different states have different rules. And one of the issues that you hear from proponents is, like, let's say I've been working as a stylist for 20 years in New York City, and then I moved to Columbus. I can't get a license because I don't have those hours, even though I have that, like, 20 years of experience. I have to go back and get much more expensive hours of schooling. And that's also another debate that's been going on for years, is what should be the relationship between states in accepting of other states' licenses? How should that happen if you have 20 years experience? Like, it's just really interesting to kind of think about, like, what do we license and why do we do it? And there's, like, no uniformity across the country.
What do other states do with the portraits of chief justices when they retire from their Supreme Courts? Because there apparently is a
legislative information,
a to-do about where to put the outgoing Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor's portrait, which she commissioned and paid for. She is historic, right?
Yeah, she is the longest serving statewide elected woman in Ohio history so far. So, mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's weird because I've only ever heard of the removal of a portrait in extreme circumstances because I used to work in Oregon, and there was a governor there named Neil Goldschmidt, who several years after he left office, it turned out that he had molested a babysitter, and they took his portrait down from the state house, and they didn't destroy it. They just put it in storage. They were like, we don't need this guy in the state house. But that's the only time I've ever in my political career heard of, like, somebody removing a portrait. I don't know if you guys have like another example.
There was, I mean, it's not serious, but when Larry Householder was elected speaker again, which I guess it would have been 2019, he had Joanne Davidson's portrait removed from the House chambers.
That's
and
right.
there's several versions of it. So there's one that, you know, I don't remember if more were made because of this or if it happened previously, but one was hung in the Davidson Theater, which is in the.
Why do you have it removed?
He didn't like her, basically. Like, I forget what he said at the time, but, you know, they were just sort of old political foes. Like, they, Joanne, put up his, when Householder was elected speaker for the first time in the late 90s, Joanne Davidson had kind of a preferred person that she wanted to have the position.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Pass the gavel and householder messed that up. I mean, there was, you know, there's just like a whole thing there. But anyways, that comes to mind. And eventually when Bob Kupp was elected speaker, who was an old friend of Joanne Davidson, she had the Davidson portrait was returned to the House chamber. So there is sort of an analog to this kind of thing. Like, but yeah, anyway.
Phew. Okay.
Portrait drama.
Yeah, portrait drama. And another drama brewing at this. Well, let's talk about once you is the Christmas cookie.
Sugar cookies.
Sugar
yes.
cookie is the official Ohio cookie.
Proposed.
It's proposed.
Possibly. Now, this is something that came out of a third grade in Cincinnati, I want to say, several years ago. So, you know that year that you learn about state government and you come down to the state house, occasionally they're encouraged to propose legislation. I think one of them was like the state fossil or the state
state reptile. Or amphibian, I forget which one.
So they always do one. And they, for some reason, that third grade, I guess, voted. They wanted sugar cookie and they petitioned for it. And I guess this has been a long time coming.
Honestly, not the worst way to make policy.
I did learn, so I tweeted something about the Ohio House passed a bill that would designate the sugar cookies official state cookie. I tweeted something kind of comical about it. Somebody responded to me and they informed me that the peanut butter blossom cookie, which is basically a peanut butter cookie with a chocolate chip in the middle, was invented in Ohio. It was a 1957 contest.
This is what I've been. Somebody said, what would be the ideal Ohio cookie? I said the peanut butter blossom.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh. Well, because it kind of fits in with the Buckeye theme.
Yes. Oh, right. God, no.
But so
I mean, it's not my favorite, but it makes more sense.
Sandusky County, a person from there, you know, invented it at that time. And so that perhaps, you know, I don't know if they have a lobbyist. You know, there's only a couple weeks left of lame duck. But
I mean, as somebody who loves peanut butter, I wholeheartedly endorse this idea. Like, I'm really sorry. Like, I love sugar cookies, too, but
I like the idea of somebody saying, I'm going to put a Hershey Kiss inside this cookie as inventing something.
Yeah.
But,
well, you know, I mean, stranger things, but this is important stuff. Glad they're getting something done down there at the State House. Stand by. We'll keep you posted on that. We have a few more minutes. They are bringing the Ohio House has approved $650 million for nursing homes. Mm. They say that it's needed for short-term relief. Was this funding from the federal government, or
it's federal Medicaid matching fund. So this $200 million is going to come out of the state general revenue fund, and then another $411 million is going to come from federal matching funds. So they decided not to go with ARPA funding for this. Instead, it's short term, one time money as they consider in the budget next year a much bigger change to the way they reimburse nursing homes.
There's a situation with nursing homes. It looks like they can't staff them properly.
I mean, that's been a long, I mean, COVID, I think, has exacerbated that problem. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those ongoing. And, you know, I think it holds the same challenge that daycare holds, weirdly enough, is that these people are notoriously underpaid. And it's very difficult, complex jobs that got even more difficult and more complex during the pandemic. And, you know, you don't want to bargain basement your daycare or your elder care. But at the same time, these people are making $12, $14, $15 an hour sometimes. It's really challenging, especially when you can go to Amazon and make more money for less headaches. At least that's the argument I hear from folks who leave.
Yeah, it's the big question, because the people on the other end who have to pay for these services, they need something that's affordable. But
yeah,
then
for sure.
The people who are working there want a good payable living wage. Mm-hmm. And so it's this weird balance. And like you said, childcare is the same thing. Yep. And so they're going to look at that next year, rebasing nursing homes and how much reimbursement do they get from the state.
This is expected to pass then.
This one-time money, I think, is expected to pass.
Mm-hmm. The bigger conversation will happen in the budget, of course, because the thing people don't realize is, what is it, like 70% of nursing home care is Medicaid or something? Like, it's an insane amount. The majority of the Medicaid budget goes to this, like, end-of-life care, just because it is so expensive that you usually burn through all your other assets and then you end up on Medicaid.
Yep.
That's the good old American
way.
That's
what happens.
We are done. We're out of time. Anna Staver, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Anna Staver is State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. And Andrew J. Tobias, thanks to you as well.
Hey, thanks.
Andrew is State House reporter for Cleveland.com. And Andy Chow, thanks to you as always.
Thanks, Ann.
Andy Chow is reporter with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. That's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.